Okay, we're back on tape two. Let me get a audio from you, Jim.
Well, I'm ready to talk again if you are.
So you're down in Santa Clara and you're finishing up a civil engineering degree, and you got these group of friends, and something major in the history of civil engineering projects occurs, and you have an angle on it. Tell us about that.
Well, no, it's not really true. I think you're referring to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I didn't have a clue what that was when I left the Bay Area. I only was off on an excursion to get away from the life I grew up in, and not out of any kind of anger or anything with my family, who I loved. A sense of adventure and a sense of going somewhere. Prior to that, I had seen pictures of a truck driving to Alaska, and that picture stuck in my head as, like, that's beyond my horizon. And anyway, when I was asked by Jim Ringstad to drive up the highway with him, I thought, there it is. There's my chance. I don't know where I'm going, what I'm doing. I'm going off to the world, to something completely unknown.
And, so it had nothing to do with the fact that the biggest civil engineering project in the history of the world was happening there?
I didn't have a clue. I didn't even know what a pipeline was.
Oh, man, I always assumed you guys saw that baby drop in your lap, especially with Ringstad being born and raised in Fairbanks.
Nope. I'm sure he had a picture of something going on, but I sure didn't. I was leaving somewhere. I wasn't going anywhere. And yeah, we had a great time. We drove up the highway. There was 1,300 miles of gravel on that road in those days, and it was a lot of potholes, and it was a slow trip. But yeah, I got up here, and there stayed with Jim's family for a while, and couldn't stay there forever, obviously. I got a job, temporary job, working for Continental Van Lines moving furniture. I had applied at every engineering company in town, but there was no work. And I used to go down to the Union Hall, Teamsters Hall, and see if there was a short call for moving furniture. And there usually was one day a week. And I don't remember what I made. $10-$15 an hour, but it was enough. I rented a room in a rooming house on Wendell Street for $25 a week. It's just a room you could sleep in. You could share the kitchen. And I just sort of existed there. There was an advertisement for needing some surveyors to start surveying some of the stuff for the pipeline that was coming up. And Jim and I both went down and applied for that. They only needed a few guys, though, and Jim had a few more connections. They hired Jim and I think they had about five survey crews that went south of the Yukon, and they surveyed the campsites for the camps that were going to be built south of the Yukon. I didn't make the cut. I was the next one that might have been hired. I kept working at Continental Van Lines. No real plans for what I was going to do, obviously. Eating hand to mouth. And then later that fall, September, the company called me up and said, hey, we need one crew to go up north and survey the center line of the pipeline and the center line of the road through Adigan Pass. And I said, that sounds good to me. And so I went out as a rodman on a survey crew. and flew into a little 20-man camp. There was camp caretaker and a cook and a helicopter pilot and a mechanic and four surveyors.
Was that like Sandilar, maybe?
It was Dietrich. Sandilar wasn't even built. And we'd fly up into Attigan Pass and unload the helicopter and put our equipment on our shoulders and walk the pass and start serving in center line of the road. It was an absolutely spectacular job. It was unbelievably gorgeous helicopter ride every morning. Worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. Made some money and had a unbelievable experience. And after that, we flew down toward the Yukon and did some more surveying down there, and then came back to town after about 2 months.
And so, say this was what was called the Hall Road.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Say what's going on there.
Well, the Hall Road had to get built alongside the work pad where they built the pipeline, so they could haul all the supplies up for the construction. And they had to build a road to Dead Horse, where the Prudhoe Bay, basically, where the terminus was. So this was pristine country. There was nothing up there. Even the USGS maps didn't show the contours. It was uncharted territory. So it was quite the experience for anybody to be up there at that time and be exploring new parts of Alaska and putting in contours and finding a path for that road. Anybody that's driven that road can appreciate how difficult it might have been. It would take hours to hike on that side slope with heavy laser distance meters on your back and get from point to point. You'd set one or two points a day if you were lucky. Very difficult.
And this was 1972.
Correct. Yeah. Wonderful experience. But that job ended, and at the end of the season, I quit and I flew back down to San Francisco and paid off a bunch of my college debt and hung out for the winter, didn't do much. And in the spring, early spring, maybe February or so, they called me up and asked me if I wanted to come back up and start designing some access roads and roads from the pipeline to the work pad. And I said, sure. So I flew back up to Fairbanks and started designing roads.
When was that?
February of 73.
I should say, when you were up, I guess it was the summer of 72 then, surveying that for the Hall Road, I hitchhiked and made my way to Alaska without telling you. I was going to stop in and visit. And I got to Fairbanks and found where you lived, except that you weren't there. You were up north. And I hung around Fairbanks only, some weeks. And then I went back, not having run into you, though I did run into our mutual pal and high school buddy, Bob Ritchie, and his wife, Bobby. And then I remember you coming back to the city after you had that Alaska job, and you looked completely different. You had a big beard on you, and you must have put on 25 pounds or more. Remember that?
Yeah, the food was awfully good. Although I actually used to go out into the shop after dinner and I was going to try and lift weights. Of course, there weren't any weights there, and I'd find the heaviest bar I could find for breaking ice and things and just do lots of repetitions on by myself in the shop, build up my muscles and just stay in shape a little bit. But I gained a bunch of weight and grew up in a lot of ways and came back a slightly different person, I'm sure. But,
Now, let's see, Christ, I'm trying to remember, but, so you would have come down, like, in the fall of 72, and then back up February 73?
Yeah.
So, okay, yeah, I can sort of remember writing you letters at that time. It was the Watergate hearings, I think, were going on. I think I was living on Duncan Street. And we wrote back and forth a little bit.
Yeah, I was up in Natigan Pass for the whole month of September and down on the Yukon River for the first 2 weeks of October. Probably made it down to San Francisco in November. Totally detached from all news. Watergate was something I didn't know about. I mean, we didn't get any news. I didn't get any news for nearly 2 months. So that stuff I was certainly not up on. But yeah, we hooked up right away and hung out. I don't even know what I did for those 2 or 3 months, to tell you the truth.
But that wasn't the period, I don't believe, where... No. Because there was a time we were roommates there on Lee Street.
Yeah, that was a different. Later. That was different. That was after. That was the next year. Yeah, because I went back up there and I worked as in the office at Michael Baker Jr. for
blocking the mic a little
bit. Until the spring, surveying started again, and I went back up north. There was 5 survey crews now that went up north, with one engineer in charge, and that engineer needed an assistant engineer to do the calculations for the surveys, for the surveyors, basically close all the traverses, and I was that guy.
And this guy, Dean Elston?
No, that was Harry Hermanson. Really great guy from Colorado, had been on pipelines and heavy civil projects all his life. He was probably 65, and a character, and a live wire, and a great guy to work for. And we spent the summer up there. I was closing traverses and operating the radio station for the air pilots coming in, and it was at the very tail end of old-fashioned surveying. We had a very simple calculator, which had maybe you could put in 10 digits after the decimal point, and it did not have sine and cosine on them. We had to use a reference book that had sine and cosine down to the seconds to 10 or 15 decimal places and enter every one of those into the traverse calculations. It was so archaic, incredibly archaic.
But that was state of the art.
It was state of the art, yeah.
HP calculator, or had they come out yet?
Yeah, well, the first HP calculator, handheld ones, came out when I was a senior in college. We were the last class to go through using slide rules. And we were kind of used to having to do that kind of thing. Having a calculator was a big step up. We didn't have to use slide rules. And within a few years, it was just, that was ridiculous. They had all the sine and cosines in the calculator. And all you did was, you know, sine of the angle or cosine and close the traverse. Anyway, Harry and I had a great time, and I worked that whole year up there into the fall, and don't remember, the season closed down at the end of the year, end of October or so, and I quit the job, and that was the year Steve Stack and I took the old FBT in November and drove it out to Boston. and back.
Cross country trip.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Jerry Doomer or somebody with you at some point?
No, well, we met Jerry Doomer in Shawnee, Oklahoma. He had joined the Peace Corps. Vista, yeah. He was working at an Indian reservation doing some work on water systems. Yeah, we just drove across the top of the country and visited friends that we knew along the way and played pool and drank beer. And we said we were going to go to visit a friend of ours in Philadelphia for Thanksgiving, and we made it as far as Spokane Thanksgiving.
What were you there?
Some girlfriends.
Well, give as many names as you care to. Philadelphia, for example.
Steve had a girlfriend in Philadelphia that Katie Young, who he wanted to see. We had some college friends and family friends from, not really family friends, but Jim Ringstad's sister Mary was going to University of Gonzaga in Spokane, and we stopped and saw her, you know.
Uh-huh. And say, you mentioned the FBT, tell people what that is.
The FBT was the fine brown truck, Steve's 1951 Ford Flathead V8. It was a wonderful truck, and he still has it.
Is that first word flying or fine?
Fine. Gotcha. The fine brown truck.
And it made it all the way from Alaska, all the way around the country and back.
All the way, the whole way, without any insurance. I don't even know that it had a legal license plate. We only got in three wrecks.
No seat belts.
No seat belts.
Three wrecks.
Yep.
Say more.
Let's see. The first one was we were in a parking lot at a store, and somebody had gotten out of their car, left the emergency brake off, and their car coasted across the parking lot and hit our truck. We were terribly offended, of course. We pushed it off the truck and let it go and drove out of the parking lot. We figured that the next car it hit would have much more time and energy to deal with the issue than we would.
You didn't set the brake on the runaway car?
No. We figured that this person needed to get caught somewhere. Second one was a guy ran a red light and plowed into the back of the back fender, and we didn't have time to deal with him either. We didn't have any insurance. He didn't either. We drove the car back home. Steve went out on a date. I pushed the fender back out using his car jack and got it far enough off the wheel so it didn't rub on the wheel, and we drove on. The third one was when we hit the Mississippi River Bridge, and there was ice on the bridge, and we spun the truck around about three or four times, and that was pretty exciting.
You're from Alaska, and you spin out?
We hit, yeah.
In the Mississippi, in the south somewhere?
Yeah, there was, it was winter. We were driving in winter, and the surface of these bridges, I guess we weren't really used to how quickly they freeze from the bottom up with this moisture on the top that looked pretty glassy. I was driving at the time. I said to Steve, does this look glassy to you? Because the road leading up to it wasn't. He said, well, sorta. And I gave the steering wheel just a little test. And holy cow, that was a mistake. We headed toward the guardrail, ready to plunge over the end of the Mississippi River, but the fender hit and it spun the back around, and we spun five times down the Mississippi River Bridge and ended up facing backwards in the right-hand lane. The other cars coming along went around us, and so we just turned around and drove off the bridge and pulled into the nearest motel and had a glass of scotch and went to bed. And it turns out we had broken an engine mount, which is a combination engine mount water pump. And hard part to get for a 51 Ford pickup truck. But Steve had a spare one in his back of his truck, and so we just went to a gas station and borrowed their tools and changed it out and drove on.
Okay, now, then that trip ended back in Alaska?
No, it ended up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. We got there, and then I think that's the year we got there in the, I don't remember, January, February, and didn't we go to Mexico?
Yeah, I think that was 73.
What happened was I went to been to Bechtel's office, where Jim Ringstad was working at the time, just to say hi to him. And they were designing the pipeline camps then, Bechtel was, and they wouldn't let me out of the office without hiring me. I ended up getting a job just because I went to go visit him. And I said, well, I can't start right away. I got to go to Mexico. So me, you, and Steve took off and went to Mexico for an excursion.
Acapulco.
Which is a whole different story. And anyway, I came back up and started in there at Bechtel designing camps. And you were working at PG&E. Steve ended up getting a job first at the local San Francisco library at the bottom of the chute where books came back in from the people that read them. But he kept trying to read every book when it came down the line. I think they fired him because he was reading too much, which didn't bother him. And he then got a job logging up north in Taylorsville, California, and spent several months up there. I don't even remember how long he spent up there. And then Bechtel transferred me up to Fairbanks in June or July. And I stayed up there working for the Bechtel Camp Department for about 18 months, designing all the camps north and south of the Yukon. There were nine north and seven south.
Just before we get there, I think that's the time we were roommates.
Yeah.
Street, and you were working right across the street from me. Both PG&E and Bechtel were on Beale Street.
Yeah.
And Mission.
Yeah.
So we were eating in those little Mexican restaurants and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There in the outer Mission.
That was a wild time. It was a lot of fun. San Francisco was then and is now a wonderful place for young people to live and have fun and work and mingle. And I have a niece now that lives there and is doing the same thing, and the lifestyle sounds so similar. Fun town, kids. Good place to grow up.
Okay, now you're back to AK. What's Bechtel got you doing?
Designing camps. First exposure to a little more structural engineering and writing specifications and things like that. Just general engineering. More of a real engineering job. And it was interesting. And I got to go be involved during the construction of the camps and inspect the construction and see how they all got put together. And that job worked out pretty well. Then when the camps got done, Alyeska needed some engineers to go work on the pipeline itself. You know, I mean, they get the infrastructure ready, and I got hired by Alyeska to go up north, Section 5-6, be a construction engineer for Alyeska, kind of like a inspector, monitor, coordinator type position. And that's when I worked for that fellow you mentioned earlier, Dean Elston. old pipeliner from Canada.
Say the year where we are.
My first, well, you know, I lived out of a duffel bag for 18 months, so where I was everywhere. Started out at Franklin Bluffs Camp, and this was 80s. Missed a decade.
Yeah.
Into 74, Steve and I drove out, beginning of 75 with Bechtel. So, 76, end of 75, middle of 75 maybe. Middle of 75, I think I started working for Alyeska. Yeah, went up to Franklin Bluffs Camp and had my own truck, and there were two of us that worked for Dean Elston. He was Alyeska's main supervisor, and our job was to keep an eye on the contractor, who was a big conglomerate pipeline contractor from the south that was had this large section of pipeline to build. And it's a good job. It was a lot of exposure to construction and a lot of experience gained, but it was also a wild time to be in Fairbanks and in Alaska. I mean, there was the legends of how the pipe, what it was like during the pipeline, were probably all true. A lot of money, a lot of work, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, 8 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and a pretty wild lifestyle. You could get into as much trouble as you wanted to.
Well, what do you remember specifically? The stories, the legends, how much money, stuff like that.
I remember being exposed to the power of the unions. Their ability to control things through many strikes, many walk-offs. I remember lots of parties every night with lots of alcohol and cocaine and whatever you wanted to get into. You could do it, gambling. All the things that they tried to keep out of the camps were there if you wanted to find them. Coming to town was just, you'd go downtown to the bars all along 2nd Avenue, and they were jam-packed full of pipeliners and whores and dancers and every kind of character you could want to find in the world. Yeah, it was a pretty wild time. But yeah, there's an awful lot of really nice, great people too, and very competent workers and intelligent men that were putting this big project together. It had all aspects of that. It was no doubt a difficult job, done under very difficult conditions.
What are some of the conditions you experience?
Well, I guess the first category is weather, you know. I mean, who could say anything about construction in Alaska without bringing that up? I mean, just cold weather, and you'd just be driving along and you'd see a giant arm of a backhoe break in half because of brittle failure during 50 below zero temperatures, and you don't normally see those kinds of things. Incredible feats of maintaining equipment. Really skillful operators digging the ditch and lowering in the pipeline. I mean, the art of pipeline construction is underappreciated, to say the least. It's very difficult to lower pipeline as big as that. And that 48-inch gas line is one of the biggest gas lines in the world, in the United States anyway. And
you said gas line.
I'm sorry, oil line. It had a 0.462 wall for part of it and 0.562 inch thick wall. It's very heavy, it's cumbersome, it's bent, they're lowering it in ditches that are steep sometimes. And they have those large side booms. If one of them topples in, everybody topples in. You know, I mean, you could kill 15 guys with one false move, and everybody knows it. It's incredible teamwork to see all of that go together. So there was all those things, good and bad.
Let me just switch the tape. So, where the hell were we?
Well, we were talking about just a difficult construction, and one of my strongest memories is there was this one superintendent on the job who I really admired. He was a guy named Pat Osborne from Oklahoma, and big, tall, 6'4" or 6'5" Indian guy. Very well respected in the whole industry, and everybody looked up to him. He had a good sense of humor, very quiet spoken. He was the assistant superintendent, so he was in charge of a lot of things. And I never forget the time they were lowering in the pipeline down Chandelier Shelf, which was a pretty steep shelf, and they had to do a long piece of it at once. There was no good place to make a splice. And Pat spent a lot of time sitting up at the site planning how he was going to do it. And he laid out all the side boom guys right where he wanted them. He stood on the other side of the bank up on a hill, way up on a hill, where he could see everything and everybody could see him. And he put on a white glove. I'd never seen anybody do that before either, so that people could see his hand. And these guys are spread out over, oh man, could have been half a mile. And every man in every rig was good at his business, and they trusted Pat completely with their lives. And he slowly would point to one operator and tell him, these are all side boom operators, and give him the signal to lift up a little bit and then cut him off. Go to the next one a little bit and cut him off. And they always knew when he was pointing at them. And he would, this took a whole half a day, get this weight of this pipeline off the side of the ditch and then out slowly over the ditch, and balancing this thing completely like a piano the whole time. No machine could take more weight than it could hold. And he's judging this thing in his head the whole time, and slowly walking this thing out and lowering it down at a very controlled rate. And this pipe is not straight, it's all bent to the bottom of the ditch. It's got both horizontal and vertical bends in it. And I was sitting up by him watching him. It was like watching a master. And he got that thing down in the ditch perfectly. And got everybody unentangled and pulled it back. And That was a, that was a sight to see.
Like a conductor.
Exactly like a conductor.
Take a cough break. Okay, we're back after a little cough break. And, you know, one other thing I was remembering. So I came to Fairbanks to stay in late 75. I think it was like Halloween. I got into Alaska and maybe November 1st in Fairbanks. And I can remember you guys were all staying at Maurice Killian's place, about you and Steve and Bernie Stack. And I flopped on the couch until I got situated out at Chino Hot Springs. And one of the things I was doing was tape recording records. So I was playing these records back in your room, I think. And I had my little tape recorder and I was taping it because that would be my winter's music. And you walked in with Dean Elston. And I said, and we were chatting away, and you introduced me. And I said something like, well, you're going to get him back to work. And he said, I had to make a special trip into town to get him. And he goes on and on about this. It was all on the tape recorder. I still have it somewhere, you know, this little recording. So maybe talk a little bit about Dean as another pipeline.
Well, Dean was my first experience on the construction side of the pipeline. When they flew me up north, he was the Alyeska rep, really, for that section of the pipeline, and I was his assistant. And he was an old-time Canadian pipeliner. He'd done more pipelining than most people could even imagine, and he was a character. He had a very funny sense of humor. He was kind of hunched over. He'd broken his back 3 times, and had white silver hair and a smile on his face, but he was feisty as hell too, just ready to sit down and drink Canadian whiskey with you and play gin rummy and talk pipelines. And he just knew everything about him, so he was in a good position for Alyeska. He knew when contractors were giving him bullshit and when they were telling the truth, and they respected him too. Yeah, he would be more than ready to sit up late at night and like I say, drink Canadian whiskey and play country music and talk. And great mentor for me, really a great mentor. And stories about pipelines he had taken out the old Canole pipeline, which I think ran down to, did it run down to Haines? Remember that Canole pipeline?
Yeah.
He pulled that old pipeline out back in the day and talked about just cutting the pipeline at the bottom of the valley and ripping it out of the ground and let the oil go where it may. And that doesn't happen anymore, but he'd seen a lot of things and he knew how to deal with people. And he'd get pretty frustrated with a lot of young inspectors coming up to him and telling him the way things were supposed to be. And he'd just get madder and madder and just say, "We need to say, listen, God damn it," he'd say, I've driven down more pipeline right of ways backwards and drunk than you've ever even seen. And here's the way it is." And tell them how it was going to happen and what was going to take place. And he was constant character on the pipeline. A lot of guys like that on the pipeline, guys that had been around and seen a lot of things and knew how to get through difficult situations and just get things done. But he was a rough and tumble guy. And I'll never forget the picture. He flew from Canada up to Fairbanks when I got married. And I guess it was 79. And We were in this Alaska Sportsman's Club there, right on the river, and late in the evening, and of course he was still drinking his Canadian whiskey. He's hunched over and telling stories as fast as he can, and he got, and he's standing next to the wall where this big caribou antler was, or was it moose? And my mother came over to meet him, you know, and my mother was a proper San Francisco lady, and Dean was a rough and tough Canadian pipeliner with whiskey, lots of whiskey inside him, and he didn't quite know what to do, and he talked about that for years afterwards, how he just got into this corner with my mother, and he didn't know how the hell he was ever going to get out of there, and he kept bumping his head on the moose antler. And between the moose antler and the whiskey and my mother, he said he just about lost it. He didn't know whether to shit or go blind, and he ended up having to just walk away. I can just see that encounter, and both of them not quite understanding what the other one was about. But he was a great old guy, really a great, great character, and quite a mentor for me personally and construction-wise.
So I think you said that that was your wedding you were talking about.
Yeah.
And he flew up for that?
Yeah, he did. He was living... Where was he living? He's living, gosh darn it, he's still in British Columbia. I think he was living in Dawson City.
Dawson City, YT.
Yeah, yeah. Last I saw him was when I drove up the highway in 83. I stopped in to see him. He was living in a little complex, around Fort Nelson, or Fort St. John, which one was it? Yeah, stopped in and saw him there, and he was pretty well ensconced there and set up okay, and it was really nice to see him and chat and had a good time. He died soon thereafter.
You remember any other really eventful moments in construction? You had that Attigan Pass. That was a pretty hairy bit of roadway and pipeline there.
Yeah, it was. At the end of my time up there, there was a big reorganization, and there were two sections of the pipeline that were critical. One was Attigan Pass, and the other was Thompson Pass. They were the last pieces of the pipeline to get built. And Attigan Pass had a problem in that they had this very unstable ground, permafrost. Lots of rock, but also lots of water and lots of permafrost. And they couldn't quite figure out a way to stabilize the pipeline. So they decided that they would have to encase it in concrete and then insulate the outside of the concrete. And this was in the middle of winter. And we had to build a batch plant at the top of the pass. And, of course, completely insulate everything, heat up the concrete, build a platform to put the pipeline on, then build some insulated forms, pour the concrete in, and hold the pipeline down so it wouldn't float.
So the pipe's in place, and you formed up around it, and
yeah,
put concrete in there.
Yeah. And then it was a 24-hour round-the-clock operation to encase that entire piece of concrete from the top of the pass all the way down the south side. It was very challenging work.
That was to keep it from... moving, to keep from
it was an
up.
Attempt to keep the heat from the pipeline from further thawing the permafrost and hopefully keep the water out. of getting close to the concrete, close to the pipeline, so that the water wouldn't, you know, pass that heat around. It actually didn't work, and we got involved. I got involved, many years later, about 86 or 87, when I came back and had started my own firm to repair that section where they put both piles and structure there to support it, because it continued to thaw. Unfortunately, the first design didn't keep enough water out, and the water got in and heated up the permafrost, and that pipe continued to settle. There was never any breakage or anything, but it was one of those high-duty maintenance issues that came up. It was a very challenging section of the pipeline to build. I was up there actually 6 months straight without leaving, and at the end of 1976, when we got it all finished and buttoned up, I quit. Said I've had enough of the pipeline. I'd been on it and off it since 72. Interestingly, I spent 5 continuous Septembers in Attigan Pass. From 72, I first surveyed the center line of the road. And 73, I was up there surveying some more and surveying access roads for Michael Baker. And 74 and 75, I was up in that area, not the whole month of September, but in September, passing through, looking at camp construction, Attigan and Chandelier. And then 75, 76, I was up there for construction through the finishing of the pipeline itself. So I spent a lot of time at Attigan Pass.
You're probably one of the only guys.
I'm the only guy. I'm sure I am the only one. I knew that area really well.
Well, I've driven over that a few times, and it's a hairy thing just to drive over, let alone try to build a pipeline across.
Yeah.
Very pretty.
Yeah, pretty steep side slopes on that road.
Anything about the non-engineering workforce, guys you met, camp life?
Every night was Friday night, and every morning was Monday morning. Met a lot of guys from all over the country. A lot of nice guys, you know. Most of the guys I hung out with were kind of like me, you know, young guys my age, some engineers, some not. Got a big kick out of meeting the pipeliners from all over the country, socializing with them, guys from Montana, Oklahoma, Texas. Interesting bunch of guys.
How different from San Francisco guys your, you know, experience?
Wow. Boy, completely different outlook on life, that's for sure. I kind of grew up with this expectation you go to college and get a job, you know. These guys grew up with an expectation you grow up and get a job on a pipeline. And their lifestyle was travel, 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 and job site to job site, and very construction-oriented. But, you know, there's a common sense of humor and a common dialogue that Americans have that you can develop within any group. Doesn't mean you always like everybody, but I never had a problem becoming friends with people from all over the country. People are very different than me. And really enjoyed talking to them, meeting them, hearing their stories, and and laughing and having a good time. It was a great melting pot. Great melting pot for all kinds of people.
Now, I was saying yesterday, I think we were driving out here, and we had some music, and we had some country music going, and I was saying, you know, you're kind of country, Jim, even though I know where you grew up. It's not country, and yet you do have this sort of country streak in you. Did that come from working with these pipeliners and stuff, or what?
I don't know if that's true, although Dean Elston always played the country music, and I loved the old country music he liked. But I mean, I would not classify myself as a country music guy in the sense that that's what I listen to most of the time. I have an appreciation for it, and there's no doubt that influences from high school and guys like Dean Elston and Harry Hermanson and those kind of guys gave me a little more of an ear for it. The kind of country that I really like has kind of morphed from just being old country, which I still really like, to the alternative country folk rock mix. That's a fusion that goes on today in the world that I think is one of the rich genres that is part of Americana sound. I like it. It's an influence for sure.
But I'm not just talking about music. I'm talking about you. And you have incorporated kind of a country streak. Sometimes you sound a little country. The kind of stories you tell and stuff. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I guess I don't see myself in my own light, perhaps. I don't know that I see that. That's kind of interesting to me. I'd have to hear it back in your words, maybe, and figure out what it is that I'm doing. That's really interesting.
Well, I was thinking some of it might have been the influence of our mutual buddy, John Paulson.
Yeah, some. I would never say that there was any one person that influenced me. I think it came from my listening experience and appreciation. I certainly think that people I've met in the past have exposed me to things.
Well, and Steve Stack, too, I think, is another guy who's had a lot of influence on you, and I sort of hear the influence and the way you...
The country or the stories or the... Yeah, is that what you mean? No doubt the people we meet, all the people we meet influence us. And in ways we don't even recognize, we start imitating each other. I'm sure I'm just as susceptible to that as anybody else could be.
Let's see. Bringing up Paulson's name makes me think you ought to talk a little bit about him. He was one of your great friends of your life and a colleague and classmate, and you both worked in the same company then. And maybe run us quickly through that.
Yeah. When I first transferred to Santa Clara my junior year, John was one of the first people I met. He was in the civil engineering class, too. He and Jim Ringstad, I think, were the guys I met first. And I really took to John. He was from this Sierra Nevada mountain area in Plumas County. And a really brilliant guy. He had genius IQ. He had a scholarship through Santa Clara. And very mild-mannered, quiet guy, tall, skinny guy, you know. We became instant friends, which was a wise move for me because he was a straight-A student and he'd help me do some homework problems. Our friendship grew, just stayed and grew. He went to grad school right after that, went to Berkeley and full ride again, got a master's in geotechnical engineering. Master's in geotechnical engineering. And worked in California for a while, and I was up in Fairbanks. Then I went, after the pipeline was over, I went to grad school at University of Washington for structural engineering, and John got a job up in Alaska. And so he would pass through, and we'd see each other quite a bit whenever he came through Seattle. And he really enjoyed Alaska as well, and ended up staying quite a while. Sort of a side story, when I ended up leaving Seattle and going back up to Fairbanks, both lived in Fairbanks, and he worked for another engineering company, but he eventually left that firm and came to work for me and became a structural engineer, even though he had his degree in geotechnical. He was so brilliant that it just really didn't matter. He was just a wonderful engineer that I was lucky to work with. Kind of a grouchy old guy, and I think that there's not a lot of people that he could work for, and I was one of them, and just because I knew him so well. But we had a long career together, and he influenced me a lot, and just because of the breadth and depth of his observations and his thoughts on life and of course his engineering skills, and he's a mentor in many ways just because of the way he thought. I was always impressed by his skills, his rational skills, and the speed with which he could recall things and draw conclusions. And God, amazing guy.
Say a little bit about him getting certified, not having studied it.
Yeah, he went on. He practiced structural engineering with me. I got him started. He soon mastered the field, so to speak. He went down to California and took the structural engineering exam, just like I had done, and he passed the structural engineering exam. He took the geotechnical engineering exam. He passed that. He's one of the few people, I'll bet, around who passed both of those tests and were registered in both professions.
And civil.
Yeah. You had to have your civil license before you could sit for the structural exam and before you could sit for the geotech exam. So that was inclusive, yeah.
One of the few guys who was a registered civil, geotechnical, and structural engineer in Fairbanks or maybe even Alaska.
At that time, there was no geotechnical and structural engineering license in Alaska. It was in California, which it's really the most difficult state to get those licenses in.
So that is pretty amazing that he passes that his first try, not having studied it, but just picked it up through you.
Yeah.
And then John, who was my close buddy too, passed away, I think it was 07, And I wrote his obit, and I remember sort of interviewing various of you guys about his work life. And I think it was Pat Reinhardt said, we referred to him as our Department of Logic. and that when there were difficult problems and nobody could quite come up with a solution, somebody would say, well, let's take it to John. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Department of Logic. Yeah, and he would sort out what the best thing to do was. And he was a character too. He would do things to bug Pat. You know, every day there was a show on KUAC called the Carl Haas, when he would play this some classic music summary with commentary or playlist or something like that. Pat hated it, and John and Pat were in the same room. And John would turn it on every day at noon. And it would just drive Pat crazy. It was years before we found out that Pat didn't really like it either. John didn't like it either. He would do it just to get under Pat's skin.
And I also gather that he was a guy who the contractors really liked, because he was kind of rooting for them, you know, and if it was a difficult problem, according to the plans, they could kind of go to him and he'd figure out a way to make it more practical or something like that.
Yeah, I think two things really. One is that his plans were usually very complete and very well back-checked and coordinated and clear. So that's always a wonderful thing on a set of drawings. And he did have an appreciation for the working man. And he really came from a very blue-collar background. And he had a love for the common working man.
Yeah. Even though I think both his parents had college degrees, but that's right. His mother was a nurse, and his father, I think, was like a milkman or something.
Yeah, he ran a dairy there, I know. His father died young. I don't remember him at all. I never met him.
Yeah, me either. But we're just off